Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. This hour, we're exploring Sonoma County's Measure J. It's a contentious initiative to ban large animal farms that could reshape the county's environmental and economic future. So what do farmers and residents stand to gain or lose? We'll find out tonight. And we'll also hear from Stanford climate scientist Rob Jackson about his new book, Into the Clear Blue Sky, The Path to Restoring Our Atmosphere, and the reasons that he remains hopeful despite the climate crisis. And later, we'll speak with New York Times reporters and authors of the new book, Character Limit, How Elon Musk Destroyed Twitter, what has been the impact of Musk's takeover on free speech and social media. But first, Sonoma County's controversial Measure J is causing debate across the county and is drawing national attention. The proposal would phase out and prohibit future concentrated animal feeding operations, known as CAFO, C-A-F-O, or essentially large poultry and livestock farms. This measure was brought to the ballot by concerned citizens who say that these operations pose serious risk to the environment and to animal welfare. Critics, however, argue that shutting down these CAFOs could negatively impact agriculture and put many jobs at risk, both locally and potentially across the country. So here to help us understand both sides of this contentious issue is Phil Barber, a staff writer with the Santa Rosa Press-Democrat who has been following Measure J closely. Welcome to State of the Bay, Phil.
Thanks, Ethan.
So, Phil, let's start by just describing, if you can, what exactly a CAFO is for our listeners.
Happy to, though, like just about everything else associated with this measure, it's a little complicated. The CAFO designation comes from the Environmental Protection Agency. It's used mostly in monitoring water quality, and it was adopted by the Yes on J team as its standard, I think because it, you know, sort of provided an objective measure and didn't feel arbitrary, although of course some on the no side claim it is. But it would limit larger animal farms, and larger would be defined by what type of animal we're talking about. There really aren't any pig farms or horse farms, or I believe even, you know, sheep farms that it would be applied to in Sonoma County. So really we're talking about dairies and poultry farms, whether they're raising those chickens for meat or for eggs. For dairy cattle, we're looking at a threshold of 700 cows. For laying hens, we're talking about 82,000 or more. And then if it is what they call a broiler facility, which is chickens raised for meat, it would be more like 125,000. There's a smaller threshold for ducks, and there likely is at least one duck farm that would be included. So those are the thresholds for large CAFOs. There's also a medium CAFO designation, but the Yes on J team, the people who wrote this measure insist with some credibility that there are no medium-sized CAFOs in Sonoma County, because really that definition comes into play only if someone is considered a point polluter that's dumping waste directly into surface water or dumping manure, and that does not seem to be happening.
And Phil, let's talk about those supporters of Measure J. Can you talk about why it was put forward and why this is happening in Sonoma County?
Definitely. And I think that this is the consensus, and I don't think the Yes on J folks would argue with it. I think that Sonoma County was targeted very strategically because it's a county that does have a lot of agriculture. And in fact, where agriculture is not only an important part of the economy, but an important part of the culture, but also is a place that leans heavily left, votes left. And so I think the organizers thought there would be a chance to pass this type of measure here, as opposed to Kern County, Stanislaus County, somewhere like that, and, you know, certainly not in Iowa, but also a place where it would actually have some meaning if it were to pass, as opposed to the city of Berkeley, which has a very similar measure on its ballot this fall, but there it's largely a symbolic measure because I don't believe they have any CAFOs.
So it sounds like there's some strategy involved here. Can you describe who these main groups are that are behind the measure and what their motivations seem to be then?
Yes, I would say that the Yes on Jay side is composed of animal welfare activists and a smaller subset of environmental activists, because there are environmental issues here as well. So, you know, I think it's safe to say that the majority of Jay's supporters probably are vegan or vegetarian, certainly support less cruel treatment of animals raised on farms. Some of the larger investors are people that, who do have a background in investing either in vegan products or in animal rights issues.
What about those who are advocating on behalf of smaller egg and dairy farms? I know that that's been one of the arguments from some supporters of Measure J, that these larger animal operations are crowding out the smaller farms. Is that accurate?
Well, as to whether it's accurate to say that the big farms are crowding out the small farms, I think that's very complicated. I think, you know, generally in any industry, it is harder for larger facilities to survive and thrive in an economy that's dominated by the large. But I would say, and this is not any sort of scientific survey on my part, but I get emails and, you know, we get letters to the editor. And in my estimation, most of the small farmers who I have heard voicing support one way or the other on this measure are opposed to it. And I think there is a feeling of solidarity. I think that whether your dairy is 70 cattle or 700 cattle, it's hard work. It's often families who have been doing it for generations. And I do think there's some, you know, recognition across the lines of size and some sympathy within the industry.
And we're speaking with Phil Barber, staff writer with the Santa Rosa Press-Democrat, about Sonoma County's Measure J to phase out large animal farms, essentially. And Phil, wanted to ask you, what are the proposed penalties for the CAFOs, these concentrated animal feeding operations, that don't comply with the new regulations? What exactly is the enforcement process here? How does this measure work for those entities that are not in compliance?
Yeah, by the terms of the initiative, the penalties are real. Now, farms would have a 3-year phase out period to come into compliance. There are a few of the farms we're talking about, I think, especially a couple of the dairies who are not that high over the threshold and could probably reduce their stock a bit and comply. Many of the farms, and especially some of the egg farms, are much larger than the CAFO threshold. And I think those are the folks who are really feeling kind of an existential threat from this. So any facility would have 3 years to come into compliance. But at the end of that 3 years, if they were in violation, the fines start mounting on a daily basis. The first fine is $1,000. The second is $5,000, and the third is $10,000, but that $10,000 fine would kick in on the third day. So those would mount rapidly. And there also is a provision in Measure J that would allow basically anybody to sue a facility if they thought they were not in compliance, or to bring a complaint that could be enforceable. That's something that the farmers worry about quite a bit. But those that's the parameters of the enforcement.
And in terms of the opposition, I'd imagine most of it is centered around the economic impact. Can you describe some of those arguments and any other opposition arguments that you're hearing?
Sure. I think it is being framed generally as a threat to animal farming. There's a perception on the side of Measure J's opponents, and I think they're at least partially right about this, that the Yes on Jay organizers really don't want animal agriculture. They don't want people eating meat on, you know, on a large scale, and they don't want chickens confined in large number to produce eggs. That's not everybody on the Yes team, certainly, and it's not part of this initiative. But the opponents of the measure, I think, see it as a threat to their way of life. Some of the farms we're talking about, some of the dairies and egg farms, have existed in Sonoma County, at least within those families, for three or four generations. Mm-hmm. They believe that if they're forced to comply with this measure, that many of them will go out of business. And they talk about a domino effect after that, where if some of the biggest dairies and poultry farms in the county go out of business, what about the feed stores that supply them? What about mm-hmm. the other farmers just growing vegetables who use chicken manure in their compost and things like that? So there is a lot of real fear for sort of the shock waves going through the economy.
Well, and also through the Bay Area and beyond, there's some very famous, well-known dairies such as Clover and Strauss based in Sonoma County. So, you know, many fans of those dairies potentially have a stake in this as well. And I know this has become very contentious among Sonoma County residents. Can you talk about the current political climate there around Measure J?
I would say it's hot. There have been a lot of No on J signs vandalized over the last couple weeks. Primarily someone sort of breaking the no off of the sign. The Yes on J team, some of those folks say that they have felt intimidated at time. There have been suggestions by a couple of political office holders, you know, smaller offices, city councils and so forth, folks complaining of pretty substantial pressure being applied by the agricultural industry in Sonoma County. I would say that by the time Election Day comes, there aren't going to be a lot of Sonoma County voters who are neutral on this issue. I think the lines are dividing for sure.
Well, and I know this measure is drawing a lot of national interest. Can you, and national funding, I think there's outside funding as well. Can you explain a little bit about why this is drawing so much attention from around the country?
Sure, and you're right about that. The biggest contributor to this initiative on either side, and by far, is Western United Dairies. They're based in Turlock. They have members all over the West, but it's not a Sonoma County organization. They've given over $500,000 to fight this measure. That's twice as much money as the entire Yes slate of donors would show. And other outside organizations have kicked in pretty substantial measures, amounts as well. The National Pork Producers Council, based in Iowa, has given about $50,000. Iowa Pork Producers Association, $25,000. A lot of farm bureaus and cattlemen's associations up and down California. And I think there's very much a reason for that. And we sort of alluded to this earlier, but I believe Measure J is really seen as a test case. I think the people who wrote the initiative would, of course, love to see it pass. I think they believe if it's even close, it could represent sort of a toehold and maybe a shift in the conversation that could build some momentum for passing measures like this elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And then conversely, the measure's opponents see this as a real threat, almost as a contagion, where mm-hmm. if Jay were to pass in Sonoma County or even be a very close vote, they're worried about the same thing that the Yes team is hopeful for, that this will yeah. spread. And again, existential threat.
Yeah, what starts in Sonoma could translate nationally. So we're just about out of time, but I have to ask you, how is it polling? Do you think it's likely to pass?
I haven't seen a reliable poll on this. My sense, just based on what I'm seeing in the community, what I'm hearing from people, and even sort of gauging the two sides, I don't think it's likely to pass. I'd be very surprised if it did. But I'm extremely curious to see how close this vote is.
Well, something else to tune into on election night. Phil Barber, staff writer with the Press Democrat, thank you so much for coming on State of the Bay and talking to us about Measure J in Sonoma County. We'll stay tuned for those election results.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Up next, we're going to hear about the role of methane reduction in curbing the climate crisis from Stanford's Rob Jackson. So stay with us.
Do you think San Francisco should create an extra tax for Uber, Lyft, and Waymo to help fund public transportation? That's Prop L on the ballot, and we're talking about it in depth tomorrow evening as part of our live and free series, The Bay Votes 2024. It's happening at our community space in downtown San Francisco tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. Come listen and share your views at 220 Montgomery Street, just two blocks from the Montgomery Street BART and Muni station. You can find more info at kalw.org under the events tab.
Hi, this is Dori Stein, producer and host of Tangents Saturday nights on KALW. Big thanks to the many generous listeners who contributed during our fall membership campaign. Your support nourishes and inspires us. If you didn't get around to it, you are always welcome to join our family. Your support at KALW.org is the fuel that makes everything possible. Thank you.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. In his new book, Into the Clear Blue Sky, The Path to Restoring Our Atmosphere, Stanford climate scientist Rob Jackson explores the urgent need to confront climate change by reversing the damage we've inflicted on the planet's atmosphere. And rather than focusing solely on carbon dioxide, Jackson emphasizes the importance of targeting methane, which is a far more potent greenhouse gas, as a critical step in combating the climate crisis. He argues that stabilizing Earth's temperature isn't enough. We must bring greenhouse gases back to pre-industrial levels to truly mitigate the damage that we've done. The book offers actionable solutions, and it tells the stories of innovative people, industries, and policymakers, and he frames the mission as a moral duty for future generations. So tonight we'll explore the science, the challenges, and the path forward toward a healthier atmosphere and future with Rob Jackson, the chair of the Global Carbon Project, a senior fellow at Stanford's Woods Institute for the Environment and Precourt Institute for Energy, and a professor of earth science at Stanford University. His new book, again, is Into the Clear Blue Sky, The Path to Restoring Our Atmosphere. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you for having me, Ethan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Rob, let me start first by congratulating you for the book. It's really an excellent read. But I wanted to ask if you could just first explain what methane is and where it comes from for our listeners and why you decided to focus so much of the book on methane solutions.
Yeah, great question. Methane is the second most important greenhouse gas after carbon dioxide. It comes primarily from oil and gas operations when we mine, extract, and use coal, oil, and gas. That delivers about one-third of human-caused methane emissions. The biggest source, though, is agriculture. And surprisingly, cows are the largest source of methane. They burp about a bathtub's worth of methane a day to the atmosphere from the microbes that are living in their rumen, in a chamber of their stomach. As cows, rice paddies, waste generation also emit a lot of methane to the atmosphere. The reason we care about methane is that it's far more potent than carbon dioxide, 80 or 90 times more potent after a couple of decades of release. And it also leaves the atmosphere a lot more quickly after only a decade. And that means if we could somehow eliminate methane emissions from all the things that we do, we could save 1 degree F of warming or half a degree C in only a decade. No other greenhouse gas provides us so much power to slow climate change.
And I was struck that there was so much focus on methane. It seems like an issue that otherwise does not get that much coverage compared to carbon dioxide. Was that part of the reason why you wanted to write this book, to raise attention about methane, or were there other things that motivated you in terms of wanting to write this book?
That's definitely part of the reason I wanted to write this book. The real reason was a search for hope for me. I've been studying climate for several decades now, and in my role as chair of the Global Carbon Project, year after year, we've tracked increases in greenhouse gas emissions. Just yesterday, in fact, we released our new global methane budget. Methane's not just rising in the atmosphere, it's rising faster than for other greenhouse gases and faster than ever before over the last five-year period. But methane's been neglected. The first major methane agreement, the Global Methane Pledge, was only initiated and signed a couple years ago. And now more than 150 nations have pledged to cut methane emissions by approximately a third by 2030. We just don't see evidence for that actually happening yet in the atmosphere. So we have a lot of work to do.
So you talked about some of the different sources of methane, and I wanted to go through some of them and talk about what might be some of the practical solutions to address them. So let's start with agriculture. You mentioned livestock in particular, and your book goes through a bunch of those solutions. Can you describe what those solutions might be to address methane from livestock?
Yeah, agriculture is the most difficult source of methane from things that we do to eliminate. So methane is formed by microbes in low oxygen, waterlogged, wet environments. So large natural sources are wetlands. It's formed in rice paddies. And the stomach of a cow is almost like a wetland. It's a watery, sloshing environment where the methane's emitting microbes thrive. We could do a couple of things to reduce emissions from cows. We can eat less beef and dairy. That's something that we can do individually. And particularly for people in wealthy countries, most people listening to this show have plenty of protein in their lives. So we can afford to eat less meat. And frankly, eating less meat makes most of us healthier. A more plant-based diet is better for our hearts, our blood, our lungs, and our overall health. So consuming less is always the starting point for climate solutions. But then for however many cows are left after we reduce the number of the global herd, which is over a billion, we need solutions that tackle emissions one cow at a time. And there's a lot of excitement here because people are using feed additives, looking at vaccines, all kinds of technologies to reduce how much methane inside the cow is generated. There are scientists here in California at UC Davis who are using seaweeds, algae that cut emissions by 80 or 90% just by adding a tiny bit of algae to the cow's diets. And that's a remarkable change. The challenge is that you have to touch a billion cows every couple of days to make that effective. So it's easy if you're in a feedlot or in a dairy, hard if you're a Wyoming rancher or a rancher in Kenya where the cows are across the open range.
What do you make of these dairy digesters that are controversial, but basically would capture methane from manure via essentially enclosed structures?
You know, of course, the best thing we can do is to not have the waste, to not have the manure at all. But since we do, I think they're an imperfect solution, but a better solution than doing nothing. So these are systems that capture methane that's emitted from waste or waste lagoons. Farmers, ranchers, companies can sometimes burn that methane for electricity. Some of them are converting it to transportation fuels and other things. So the climate space is full of different technologies. All of us have our favorites. Some people only want renewables in the solution set. Other people want nuclear or gas with carbon capture and storage. So the climate space, we're going to need lots of solutions, and they won't all be our personal favorites. And methane digesters, they're not perfect, but they're better than doing nothing by a long shot.
And of course, as you mentioned, methane comes from mostly human sources, mainly our natural gas or really fossil gas infrastructure. And one of the most striking chapters, I thought, was how you have been going around some of our major cities and essentially measuring massive methane leaks just from our natural gas infrastructure under our city sidewalks. Can you talk about why that is and what we can do to fix the methane leaks?
Yeah, sure. We did the first studies looking at methane leaks across cities. So we put new methane analyzers in the backs of cars. I did this with my colleague Nathan Phillips at Boston University. So imagine putting an instrument in a car, having a GPS unit on the car, and literally driving a city like Boston or Washington, D.C. or Manhattan, block by block, like a lawnmower, over and back, up and down, until you've covered every street in the city. That's what we did. We found thousands of leaks in Boston, 6,000 in Washington, D.C. And most of these leaks are the legacy of old infrastructure. There are cast iron pipes in our eastern and midwestern cities that have been underground almost back to the Civil War. It's almost inconceivable that we would be using pipelines that are 100 or even 150 years old. We can try and fix those leaks one at a time, and that's what gas companies do. But the better way to eliminate those leaks is to switch our homes from gas to cleaner electricity. And that's something that listeners can do individually. It's something that I've done in my home. We can choose to go with electric heat pumps to cool and heat our homes, electric water heaters, electric induction stoves that are faster, cleaner than gas, and that don't emit pollutants like NOx gases and benzene into the air we breathe.
Well, that was one of the other striking parts of this portion of your book, which is the indoor air quality pollution, the indoor air quality harms that we're doing to people who are, unbeknownst to them, emitting some very toxic gases into their homes from these natural gas appliances. And you had a very striking story of a woman in Oakland who had no idea, once you did the measurements, just how much pollution she was exposing herself and her family to. Can you talk about the indoor air quality risks that people face from burning fossil gas and these appliances in their homes?
I can. And one way to think about it is that no one would stand over the tailpipe of a car breathing in the exhaust. We just wouldn't do that. We know it's not safe. And yet we stand over a stove hour after hour, meal after meal, breathing in the same pollutants that are generated in the tailpipes of our cars, NOx gases, benzene. And one reason to care about this is that there's a good news side to what's happening with air quality. Our air outdoors in the U.S. is much cleaner than it was a few decades ago. We've done a lot to improve our outdoor quality, reduce pollution levels, and we're spending more time indoors. The indoor sources of pollution are starting to dominate some people's lives, and that's what we study. We've shown that every time you turn the burner or an oven on with a gas stove, it generates NOx gases that trigger asthma, wheeze, and other problems for our kids, and especially older people. We did the first study showing that they emit benzene in the high temperatures of the flames. Benzene is a carcinogen, and no one wants to breathe that. Perhaps most surprisingly, the pollution doesn't stay in the kitchen. It migrates down the halls. We've shown concentrations in bedrooms rising above state, federal, and international health standards for hours after the stove is off, back where our kids sleep in the farthest bedrooms from the kitchen.
And Rob, in your book, you talk about environmental justice as a growing concern, given that it's often folks in marginalized communities that are bearing the brunt of not just pollution, but climate change impacts, switching over to electric appliances from fossil gas-based ones. That's an expensive switch. How do we marry environmental justice concerns with the expense of transitioning our buildings to electric appliances?
Yeah, really great question. And of course, the best way to do this isn't to replace a perfectly good gas stove or gas appliance today. It's to transition that appliance to a cleaner technology when the appliance is at the end of its lifetime. But we've done a lot of work in the Central Valley and lower income communities. I work with the Central California Asthma Collaborative to measure the pollution that people breathe indoors and to try and help them reduce risks for their kids and families. And poorer people in the U.S. and around the world breathe the dirtiest air outdoors. Like Bakersfield's the dirtiest air in the United States for a city, and they breathe dirtier air indoors. They're living in tighter quarters. Often they rent. Their appliances may be older and less well-maintained. So we have both a responsibility and an opportunity to improve people's lives by helping them to transition to cleaner fuels like electricity in their homes. It's not always cheap, particularly if they have to rewire their homes, but that's one reason I support future building codes or REACH codes. The next home that's built should be cleaner electric, not dirtier gas.
And last question on methane, although I know we can spend a lot of time talking about it, is what about industrial methane emissions from oil and gas operations and maybe other industrial sources of methane?
Yeah, methane is emitted all along the natural gas and oil supply chain. The emissions or leaks start when we're drilling holes into the ground, when we're pumping up fossil fuels, when we're transporting it across pipelines into our cities, like Boston and Washington, D.C. And frankly, the leakage continues as the methane enters our homes. We documented that stoves in American homes emit or leak as much methane as a comparable amount of pollution from 500,000 U.S. cars. So all along that process, we're bleeding a little bit of methane into the air. And once again, long-term, the best way to eliminate that pollution and the carbon dioxide generated from burning it as a fuel is to switch to cleaner technologies like electricity. That's something that we can do individually. And then there are other solutions that we can't do on our own that we need systemic change for.
So if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about reducing emissions and how to tackle climate change with Rob Jackson, chair of the Global Carbon Project and author of the book Into the Clear Blue Sky, The Path to Restoring Our Atmosphere. Just a quick note for listeners, today's interview was actually pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take any live questions or comments, but we'll be back with you live next week, and we'd love to hear from you then. So, Rob, one of the big sections of your book deals not with reducing emissions, although that's the first and priority focus that you talk about, but it's about trying to draw down the emissions that we have already put into the atmosphere since the industrial age. So you discuss some different drawdown technologies, and they're controversial because many people feel like it's a way to allow oil and gas industry maybe to continue polluting or takes our eye off the ball on reducing emissions. So can you talk about your general take on the need for what's called carbon capture, drawing down the greenhouse gas emissions that are already up in the atmosphere?
I will. And as I talk about or discuss in the book, my thinking about these technologies has changed. It's changed in part because we've seen decade after decade of high emissions continue to put carbon dioxide and methane pollution into the air. And there are now a trillion tons of carbon dioxide floating around in our atmosphere that will still be there for the most part in thousands of years. It's a big difference in that sense from methane and CO2. Methane disappears after only a decade. So that's the good news part of the superpowered greenhouse gas. But carbon dioxide just sits there sloshing around like water in a bathtub, and it won't go anywhere unless we deploy technologies to remove it from the atmosphere. Now, the problem with deploying those technologies is they're expensive. It's always more expensive to remove a dilute gas from the atmosphere than it is to clean it up at the point source. I sometimes say it's easier to blot a drop of ink with a tissue than it is to clean the ink from your jeans or from a glass of water. The same is true for greenhouse gas pollution. We don't want to have to grab greenhouse gases like a needle in a haystack. It's more expensive. It's energetically difficult. But with carbon dioxide, frankly, we've left ourselves no choice. Most scenarios suggest we'll overshoot temperature thresholds. We're at the door of 1.5 C on our way to 2 degrees C. And I think reluctantly that we need to develop and deploy these carbon removal technologies. And we need to talk about who's going to pay for that.
Over. So, Rob, in your book, you mentioned a number of different technologies to draw down greenhouse gases. Can you talk about one of them that is particularly exciting to you or particularly innovative?
I think the technology that I was most struck by when I wrote the book, I traveled around the world. I went to Iceland to visit a geothermal plant where carbon dioxide has been bubbling out of the ground with the water that they use to generate steam and use for heating. And so companies there are using carbon capture technologies, not just to put that carbon dioxide back into the ground, but to draw CO2 down from the atmosphere. And then they're essentially making fizzy water, like a kitchen seltzer machine. They put this carbon dioxide into water under pressure, so it's bubbly. They pump that water underground, and lo and behold, the carbon dioxide precipitates in only a year or two. It literally turns to stone. And the interviewer, an engineer from Iceland, said, it's not rocket science, it's rock science. And so that was a really nice example to see.
Yeah, the Medusa approach of what to do with the carbon dioxide. And then you also talk about a controversial form of carbon capture, if you can call it that, I think you can, which is BECCS, bioenergy with carbon capture and sequestration. Can you talk about what BECCS is and what the source of controversy is and why you think it's important?
Yeah, BECCS, B-E-C-S, stands for biomass energy with carbon capture and storage. And we produce a lot of ethanol in this country, transportation fuel. Some people view that as a climate solution. I view ethanol subsidies as more of a subsidy for the agricultural industry than anything. But we are heavily invested in the United States, and we might as well do it as well and as cleanly as we possibly can. Companies, I chronicle Archer Daniels Midland in the book. They have a plant in Illinois, in Decatur, where they produce, I think it's millions of gallons of ethanol at this facility. And the facility is like brewing beer if you've ever done homebrew. You add in sugars, and some for beer, it can be just table sugar. They bring plant material and waste material. they grow microbes, things like yeast, in that water. And the yeast chews up the sugars and the organic matter and bubbles off carbon dioxide. Now, traditionally, Archer Daniels Midland let that CO2 go to the atmosphere. But now they are capturing that carbon dioxide and pumping it underground a mile or more to keep it out of our air. Now, that may not be each individual listener's perfect climate solution, but it's better than letting the CO2 go into the air. And that's BECCS. The advantage of BECCS is that it uses plants to capture the energy that is needed for the process. And BECCS biomass approaches are the only ones that actually provide energy where you can make electricity or transportation fuels rather than requiring energy, which all of the other direct air capture approaches need. It's energetically expensive if you don't use plants or some other ways of capturing solar energy.
So let's talk about some of the policy solutions that we need to put in place to further some of the different technologies that you talk about in the book. And one of the precedents that you cite, interviewing former Secretary of State George Shultz, who I know was at the Hoover Institution and served under Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, he helped negotiate an agreement on the ozone layer. Can you talk about these kinds of international precedents and what you would hope to see and like to see and maybe is feasible to imagine happening when it comes to, from a policy perspective, addressing this issue and promoting the technologies that you describe in the book, among others?
There are lots of international climate agreements or environmental agreements that have helped the Earth and made us healthier. The Montreal Protocol is one. George Shultz was instrumental in convincing Ronald Reagan, the president, to sign the Montreal Protocol as a treaty after the Senate ratified it. That treaty protected the ozone hole. It's still saving lives today. It saves us many degrees of warming. The world is a much better place because of the international consensus around saving the ozone hole. It isn't just ozone. Look at lead. When we chose in the U.S. and around the world to eliminate lead in gasoline, today our children have 90% less lead in their blood than they did a couple of decades ago. Our kids are smarter. Lead literally harms our brains and lowers IQ. So we have lead levels in blood are lower, yet we have the Montreal Protocol. The Clean Air Act saves hundreds of thousands of lives a year at a 30-fold return on investment as a bipartisan environmental bill. So I look to the Montreal Protocol as the best, most important environmental agreement that was ever put into place. It's not the same as climate change because for the Montreal Protocol, we were able to swap one family of chemicals for another. We didn't have to transform our whole way of cooling, for example, developing new cooling technologies. Climate's a tougher problem, but we need to celebrate the successes that have happened in the past. And people like George Shultz, a Republican, I might add, helped make some of those happen.
We're speaking with Rob Jackson, chair of the Global Carbon Project, a senior fellow at Stanford's Woods Institute for the Environment and Precourt Institute for Energy, and a professor of earth science at Stanford University. And Rob, I know for your book, you interviewed a lot of different activists and innovators and policymakers. Was there anyone whose work particularly inspired you or surprised you in an interesting, unique way?
So many people inspired me that I was able to speak with. People working in companies, people working individually. I loved a guy I met named Mats Karstrom. He's a high school teacher. He has spent 40 years of his life protecting forests. He lives in Scandinavia, and he engages his students. He's engaged hunters to identify forests that are high in diversity, that have endangered species. He has saved many forests. So it's a testament to what people can do with dedication and passion. I talked to Rev Yearwood, who co-founded the Hip Hop Caucus, and he believes strongly that climate justice, voting rights, and disaster relief are closely intertwined. He's done a lot of work on hurricane relief. He came from the Gulf Coast. His group, the Hip Hop Caucus, has helped people recover from hurricanes like Katrina. And he's bringing a multicultural perspective, bringing music, hip hop artists, to the environment and the climate space, and reaching people that I wouldn't reach, frankly. So it takes a village, and it takes a lot of different people from different backgrounds.
So Rob, I'd like to close here by asking you to end with some practical advice for our listeners. What are the most meaningful actions that you think an individual can take to try to reverse climate change? What should we be doing as individuals here?
You know, the best ways for us to make a difference for climate in our lives is to think about the food that we eat, the fuels that we use to power our homes, whether it's fossil gas or cleaner electricity, and how we move around the world. Do we walk, bike, or take public transport? We have to drive. Do we drive an EV instead of a polluting gasoline-powered car? Most of our emissions come from things at home and from transportation. So those are the places I live to. Those are the things that we can choose to change individually, particularly people who are wealthier. And I acknowledge that many of the poor in the United States might not be able to control the appliances that in their homes they rent. They may not have money to change their appliances the way that I do. So I look for homes and transportation to begin with. Individually, we can reduce emissions. We can consume less. And then we have to look to systemic change. You and I can't fix the steel industry that, if it were a country, would be the third biggest polluter on Earth. It's responsible for about 10% of all carbon dioxide emissions. Those changes require a carbon price like they have in Europe and we don't have in the United States. As long as a greenhouse gas pollution is free, any climate solution that we bolt onto an industrial process will always be more expensive than free. So governments and policies will have to help us clean up heavy industries like steel, cement production. And ultimately, we've got to have a carbon price. There was just a study out a few weeks ago that looked at climate policy around the world. And perhaps not surprisingly, the only climate policy that they found worked consistently to reduce emissions was to price greenhouse gas pollution. That's where we need to head ultimately if we're ever going to solve the climate crisis.
Well, there's obviously so much more we could talk about. It's such a big problem. And you detail so many of the critical solutions, but we're going to have to leave it there. My guest tonight was Rob Jackson, Stanford climate scientist, chair of the Global Carbon Project, and author of the new book, Into the Clear Blue Sky, The Path to Restoring Our Atmosphere. Thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay, Rob.
Thank you, Ethan. It's really been great to be here. There's a lot of hope and a lot of opportunities to make a difference in our lives. So don't despair. I think about going from climate despair to climate repair. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us. And we'll have a link to your website on our State of the Bay page. And coming up after the break, you'll hear more from State of the Bay. So stay tuned.
This month, KALW's The Bay Votes 2024 series is taking over Baymaine. KALW has partnered with the League of Women Voters of San Francisco, sponsoring events all over the city to help inform voters. And this week, we'll meet the League's team of volunteers. We'll hear from San Francisco's mayoral candidates, and we'll hear from people running for the San Francisco schools and the City College Boards of Education. It's all about the upcoming election this week, Monday through Friday at 11:30 a.m., only on KALW.
Hi, this is John Carroll, Director of Advancement here at KALW, and we've just wrapped our four-day membership campaign. And I want to thank everyone who's made a donation. This is listener-supported public radio, and we couldn't do it without you. We appreciate you as a listener, and we're grateful for your financial support. If you didn't make it, it's not too late. You can always help out by going to KALW.org and clicking the donate button, and thank you very much.
Tonight, we have the pleasure of speaking with two remarkable journalists whose new book takes us behind the scenes of one of the most turbulent corporate takeovers in recent history. Joining us are Kate Conger and Ryan Mack, technology reporters for the New York Times. And their new book, Character Limit, How Elon Musk Destroyed Twitter, dives deep into the dramatic events surrounding Elon Musk's $44 billion acquisition of Twitter, now rebranded as X, and the subsequent unraveling of one of the world's most influential social media platforms. So welcome to State of the Bay, Kate.
Thank you so much for having us.
And also want to welcome you, Ryan.
Thank you, Ethan.
All right, well, let's dive into it. First of all, congratulations on the book. It's a riveting read, really hard to put down. And through this investigative lens, you chronicled what was a very chaotic transformation of Twitter that captures the erratic behavior of Elon Musk, some of the seismic shifts in leadership and policy that followed, and many people who use Twitter, I think, experienced firsthand. So it's really an extraordinary tale, and it's still unfolding, of course. So I first wanted to ask, how did you decide to divvy up the storytelling?
Ryan had covered Elon for a long time, prior to the takeover. And so he was able to just take on a lot of the early history of Elon. And I have been covering Twitter for a long time prior, so a lot of the early history there I was able to take on. But a lot of what you read in the book, we really did together.
Well, and Ryan, I understand Musk declined to meet with you for this book. Was he aware that you were writing the book? Have you received any reaction from him?
So we sent multiple requests for emails in the process. And towards the end, when we were doing our fact-checking, we sent him 518 questions over email, giving him a chance to respond to everything that would be in the book and talk to us. And he never took that opportunity. We haven't heard from him. The only thing we've really seen is on his Twitter feed or his X feed the other day, someone mocked our book and put a photo of it online, and he responded with two laughing emojis. So that's the review we've gotten from him so far.
The two emoji review. Well, Kate, let's delve into the book a bit here. So it covers an acquisition of Twitter by Musk in really great detail. Can you walk us through just briefly, if you can, how the acquisition came about and specifically what role Jack Dorsey played? And Dorsey, of course, the co-founder and former CEO of Twitter in that transaction.
Sure. So there was precedent for an investor coming in and putting pressure on the company. That had just happened to Jack not long before Elon launched his takeover. An outside investor had come in and bought up shares in the company and tried to push Jack out. And it made him really resentful. It made him really angry. And it kind of alienated him from leading the company. So he started to take a more hands-off approach. He felt like Wall Street was too enabled to meddle with his decision-making. And then when Elon came in and started doing the same thing, buying up shares and trying to have an influence on the company, Jack actually reached out to him and said, Wall Street is too much in control here and Twitter needs to be a private company in order for you to make changes. And so kind of planted the seed with Elon that he should buy the company outright and take it private.
And was Musk's acquisition of Twitter inevitable, or do you think things could have played out differently?
I think it definitely could have played out differently. It was such a sort of whimsical decision for Elon Musk. He didn't think it through deeply. He has told people close to him that it could have been the worst mistake of his life. I think when he first put his offer on the table to buy the company, he expected the board to decline it, and that didn't happen. And so I think he was a little bit taken aback by the fact that he was then suddenly on the hook to pay $44 billion for this company.
And Ryan, you've covered Musk extensively. How would you describe his personality based on your history covering him and covering him in this book?
His personality is one of confidence, especially as a businessman. He has confidence that he can solve these really tough problems because he's done it in the past. He's electrified vehicles when people have told him it's not possible. He has put things into space and landed them on barges in the middle of the ocean when people told him it wasn't possible. And so that kind of personal confidence gave him this idea that he could run a social media company. He could run Twitter. How hard could it be? And that was the kind of hubris he brought into this takeover, and one that I think has plagued him since day one. It's this misunderstanding that this is something he can engineer his way out of when it's actually a social problem. And Twitter at its heart is a people company, essentially. You're trying to figure out how to connect people online and do so in a way where they're all decently happy and coming back and visiting the site at all times. And I think it's that hubris that has undermined him from day one, whether that's not understanding how advertising works on the platform or how people communicate or what they come to Twitter for. And I think that is one of the main takeaways of our reporting.
And have you noticed his behavior or personality changing, becoming more erratic?
I think he has changed a lot. One of the things that we did in reporting this book was we went back to the beginning of his Twitter history and read all of his early tweets. And it's really startling to see how much he's shifted from that time period. His early tweets are very generic, normal posts about taking his kids ice skating and visiting the Tesla factory. And now we see him at this point where he's posting sometimes upwards of 75 times a day. A lot of it is conspiracy or really abrasive content.
And of course, he's called himself a free speech absolutist. Can you just describe a bit about what the content moderation practice dilemma has been and what Musk's approach has been to try to address this challenge?
Sure. So it's interesting because he has talked about being a free speech absolutist, and Twitter in its early days would sometimes refer to itself as the free speech wing of the free speech party. And, you know, what the company found over time was that it was enabling and becoming a home for a lot of harassment campaigns and a lot of bullying. And it made people not want to use Twitter at all or be scared to post there because they were afraid they might become a target of that kind of harassment. And so it had a silencing effect over the network, and it was actually suppressing speech. And so they shifted into this phase of moderating the most hateful and abusive content, removing it from the platform so that the platform could grow and enable more kinds of speech. And Elon has really tried to shift back to those early days. He's obviously reinstated a lot of accounts that were banned, most notably, of course, President Trump's. And I think it has really shifted the tenor of the platform to be a little bit more abrasive again. And Musk has said that what he wants to achieve is this combative effect on the platform. He's compared it to video games where you're fighting with another player. And that's the vibe that he's going for.
He's also blocked competitors' links and linking to things like Substack in the past before he was heavily criticized. He's throttled links to news outlets, including the New York Times. It's just kind of ironic. There's so many contradictions he makes for himself. So it's very selective in a way. Think of something like India, for example, where there's a repressive government that asks for links to documentaries that are critical of the current administration be taken down. He's complied with those orders in India. He has not complied in Brazil, for example, where he has gotten X banned. So it's a kind of weird understanding of what free speech means, and it just depends on who he's allied with and where his political friends are.
And what his personal incentives are, seems like is a dominant factor.
Yeah. There's a great anecdote we have in the book of Vijay Gadde, who's the departing chief legal officer, who has a meeting with him, 30-minute meeting, literally the day before the transaction closes and she's fired. And she raises these issues with him. She asks, what happens when you're in India, for example, and the government asks you to take down content, but you're trying to get your Tesla vehicles into the market there? Like, where your alliance is going to be, how do you navigate that problem? And it's something he hasn't thought through. There's plenty of conflicts around the world for him.
And of course, the subtitle of your book is How Elon Musk Destroyed Twitter, which is kind of a bold claim, given that Twitter is still in effect here. It's still operating. So just to close by asking each of you, what is your impression of what the future of the company holds?
Yeah, so I'd push back on that, actually. It's not Twitter anymore. It's X, right? So he's completely changed the name. It's a completely different platform. You look at how they've branded it and how they talk about it. From a financial perspective, he has destroyed value. He bought it at $44 billion. Fidelity earlier this week marked it down to about $9 billion in valuation. That's a tremendous destruction of wealth. You know, he's cratered the ad business. He's driven people away from the platform. And I think that's Elon's legacy from a financial standpoint.
Yeah, and I spoke a little bit earlier about how harassment and bullying online can end up suppressing speech. And I think we've very much seen that with X. We've also seen a really significant decay of its technology. The other day, Elon had Trump on for a live streamed audio conversation, and it took them almost 45 minutes to get it to work. And it's the kind of technological malfunction that you might expect to see from a small startup, perhaps, but certainly not a company that's been around for more than a decade. The company used to publish transparency reports biannually and stopped doing that for a long time after the takeover. They just recently put out their first transparency report in a long time to talk about the government requests that they've received to take down content. But again, when you think about it from a free speech perspective, it's very important to know, when is the government asking for content to be removed from the platform? And that's something that immediately faded away in the wake of the takeover.
Well, thank you for coming on to State of the Bay and telling us this story.
No, thanks, Ethan. Thanks for having us.
Thank you
Kate
so Conger, much.
Kate Conger and Ryan Mack are technology reporters for the New York Times and authors of the new book, Character Limit, How Elon Musk Destroyed Twitter.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 for an update on Oakland's upcoming elections and a discussion about the Bay Area's nursing shortage. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, you can visit our page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, just let us know. You can email us anytime at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Ann Harper. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.